This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
We also have Warren Reinch.
Thanks for having me.
And from our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
The last day of 2021. What a year this has been. I loved seeing Stephen Fleury's first year in review Trumpet Daily episode yesterday, focusing on America. It's stunning what has happened in this country in the past 12 months. And it just really packs a wallop the way they put it all together. I highly recommend you watch that if you haven't done so. I haven't yet had a chance to see part two, the global year in review, but I look forward to that. Our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, gave a blockbuster Key of David program last week about a fascinating and prophetically significant dynamic in German politics, the power of the industrialists in that country. He's working on a feature story for the coming print edition of The Trumpet on that subject. Well, more evidence of this emerged recently. We'll lead off with this story. We'll go straight to Richard Palmer.
Yes, we recently got an interesting little tidbit of information from the outgoing German government. Just before leaving office, German Chancellor Angela Merkel and her government approved two big arms exports to Egypt. And this caught our attention because these kind of, you know, typically if you're an outgoing government in Germany, you know, this is like the U.S. government after the November election, but before the January inauguration, where, you know, the government tends to move into a caretaking role, and it doesn't make any big significant decisions because it's just holding water now or treading water until the newly elected government comes in and takes its place. So this was the same kind of time period for Germany, and they have the same kind of norms. And you can see why, because any decisions that they make, they can't be held accountable for those decisions by the electorate. Whatever happens, they're coming out of here on the same day. But we've seen in the past, one particular event, a decision taken during this time period where the then German Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder approved this pipeline project with Russia that we've talked so much about. That came right at the end of his program. It was something that wasn't popular. He didn't want to be accountable for that electorally. And so, you know, he came in and he squeaked that in at the end of his administration where he couldn't be held accountable for that. Angela Merkel did the same thing, but with arms trade to Egypt. There's some fairly significant arms deals. They're selling three frigates to Egypt, a particular type of submarine as well to Singapore. Air defense systems to Egypt as well. In total, it was $5.6 billion worth of arms deals. And all these last-minute deals actually made 2021 Germany's biggest year for arms exports to date, setting a new record. So these were some very significant arms deals that they were getting in here.
So, Richard, how do you see this underscoring what Mr. Fleury was talking about in that Key of David program?
Well, fundamentally, it proves that there is an agenda within Germany that is being pushed forward regardless of what the public wants. So they want to get certain things done. And if those things are unpopular, they'll find ways to do it, like they did here by having this kind of go through in a way that didn't have any democratic accountability. In this case, we've talked before about how Germany wants to, they see there are people within Germany that see a deal with Iran a confrontation with Iran, I should say, on the horizon. They believe Germany needs to prepare. They believe one of the best ways to do that is to sign arms deals, to create alliances with anti-Iranian countries across the Middle East. They see Egypt in that anti-Iranian camp for now. And so therefore they're working to strengthen the Egyptian government and to build a relationship with the Egyptian government. But they're pursuing that policy regardless of any kind of democratic mandate. And this is, you know, the incoming government was in on this too. So the new chancellor in the old government, he was the finance minister. He was one of the top people in this cabinet. He probably could have stopped this if he wanted. You know, that's a position where you can cause a lot of trouble if you throw all your toys out the pram. And even some of these other parties that are into government, like the Greens Party, that very publicly generally has an anti-arms export stance, could have worked to stop this, but didn't, which kind of indicates that a lot of that anti-export stance is more posturing and rhetoric, and really they're on board with this as well. So you see a lot of the – Mr. Flurry talked about how, well, Angela Merkel moved forwards with the Nord Stream pipeline because of the pressure she was under from German business leaders. She allegedly said she had no choice. These leaders were too powerful to resist. And you see Germany's foreign policy being pushed forwards again in some of these fairly strategic directions, regardless of what the electorate want.
That Key of David program really drew attention to some very important prophecies in Revelation and some statements that Herbert W. Armstrong made about Germany that have shown themselves to be accurate based on information that has come out since then. What is it that we are so concerned about looking at these the power that these industrialists have within Germany?
Right. So pretty much as soon as Germany surrendered in 1945, Mr. Armstrong was saying, Germans have gone underground. The Nazis have gone underground. They plan on coming back again on the third try. And what is really remarkable about that is he said that without any physical evidence, shall we say. You know, he was making those statements, although there was some, I should say, but we've nowhere near the wealth of evidence we have for those statements now. That you know, he was making these statements, and now we have, and one of the things Mr. Flurry drew attention to in this article was a 1944 document where a whole group of business leaders agreed to go underground and to work to kind of bring about Germany's greatness and this same kind of Nazi empire later in the future. And we've also had since then had investigation after investigation finding that Germany's army, Germany's intelligence service, all of the German government was thoroughly infiltrated by people who had been very senior within the Nazi administration and had since gone underground. Now, the main evidence that Mr. Armstrong was basing those forecasts on, that analysis on, was the Bible. And it has been proven completely and repeatedly correct. And it's particularly, he was basing that on Revelation chapter 17 and verse 8 that describes this beast power, this military power within Germany and within Europe, going underground, going into the bottomless pit, as it's called in that verse. But underground, as Mr. Flurry talks about, would be a better translation. It comes and it goes, it hides, and then it reemerges sometimes even two or three generations later. And Revelation chapter 17 gives us, you know, it dates that prophecy. It dates when Mr. Armstrong was even talking about it. It tells us that this Nazi beast would go underground, would disappear for a while. People would think that it was defeated, and it would come back as if from nowhere. And what we're seeing in some of these arms deals, and what we're seeing in the Angela Merkel's pressure over Nord Stream 2 that Mr. Flurry talked about, is evidence for this, evidence of that underground emerging beast influencing what is going on the world scene now. That, okay, yes, that you had these business leaders in 1944 going underground, hiding and disguising their ambitions. And now you see those ambitions being exerted once again. So it's a dramatic fulfillment and proof of what Mr. Armstrong was saying, and a dramatic fulfillment of Bible prophecy.
Well, we do have an article from Josue Michels up on the website about this. Outgoing German government approved record weapons exports. And that links to that Key of David program from Gerald Flurry. I'd really encourage you to watch that if you haven't done so, and to check out Josue's article. We'll link to both of those in the show notes for today's program. Thank you very much for that, Richard. I really look forward to that upcoming article from Mr. Fleury. Israel is working to degrade the danger posed by Iran, and it undertook a significant series of airstrikes in a port in Syria. To learn about this story, we'll turn to Warren Reinsch.
On Tuesday, an Israeli airstrike targeted the port shipping container area of a Syrian coastal city of Latakia. The blasts and huge fires that resulted burned all day and night as the firefighters worked to put out the fire. Another attack happened just earlier this year on December 7th. And although Israel hasn't officially come out and claimed either of the attacks, it follows an established pattern of Israeli attacks. It's very common for Israel to proactively strike against Iranian targets in Syria before they get close enough to threaten Israel itself. And that has resulted in hundreds of airstrikes since the Syrian civil war erupted in 2011. Iran was quick to throw its support behind the Syrian president back then. And since then, the relationship has gone downhill. Because Iran's interests are interest in Syria is all about attacking Israel, that has caused a lot of damage to be done in return as Israel continues to strike back against Iran. And because of that, Syria is having to pay the price for all of these airstrikes. They're having to put out the fires, they're having to pay for reconstruction, they're having to clear away the rubble, and it's creating a divide between this relationship, between Syria and Iran. Usually Iran would go through southeastern Syria, but because of all the airstrikes that Israel is conducting, they have been forced to find another means of supplying their terrorists. Proxy Hezbollah in Lebanon, and to do that they have been looking at using the port facility there at Latakia. And just in 2019, a couple years ago, they signed a lease to use the storage container area of that port. A lot of reporters believe that contract later fell through, but there's been a lot of evidence, such as this attack, that Iran has been allowed to use that facility. Because of how long it took to put out the fire, a lot of reporters are saying that there was very likely flammable material inside of those containers. One reporter, an anonymous port source from the area, from that port in Latakia, said, quote, "These blasts and huge fires were caused by the explosions from munitions stored in the warehouse close to the commercial cargo." And then he later told one of the reporters that this was likely Iranian munitions that had arrived there just a month earlier. So Syria's in a position where it's finding itself having to deal with the aftermath of Iran's actions, and it's causing a divide between the two nations. Something else that is really interesting is that Russia has a base. I think it's only it's really close. It's maybe 12 miles away. And they have the S-400 air defense system, which is a very good air defense system. It is one of the best in its class. Yet they chose not to intercept these missiles, even though they're very close to their own military bases. And this is what Seth Frantzman from the Jerusalem Post said about that. He said, "It could be that Russia has no interest in defending illegal Iranian shipments of munitions to Latakia," which is really important because Russia is the only other really key or big friend of Syria. It's always been Iran and Russia. And the fact that Russia and Syria are the ones mainly having to pay for all the damage, we're starting to see a divide between those three nations, when we're starting to see Syria aligning more with Russia than with Iran. And that's exactly what the Bible says is going to happen.
Yeah, this is really what we've been watching for all along. For, you know, as this civil war has been going on in Syria, we've been talking about this divide that the Bible prophesies between Syria and Iran. And for as much influence and funding and as big of a presence as Iran has had in Syria, in some ways it's been kind of counter to what you would expect. Like, that prophecy is We've talked quite a lot about that, but there hasn't necessarily been a tremendous amount of evidence that that would actually happen. This is actually showing a bit of a divide here where Syria would pull away from Iran.
Correct. Yeah. And there's more articles coming out about this every day. I think I saw one earlier. It was from the Times of Israel. And there was a Quds Force commander. So it's an Iranian general in Syria. And he came out and I think he admitted to some they were using Syria. He said that they were using Syria to bring in certain military armaments and munitions, and it was in an area that they weren't allowed to do that by the Syrian regime. And then the Bashar al-Assad, the president of Syria, came out and he actually shunned this this commander, this Iranian general, from entering the country. And one of the, I think it was a Saudi television station, quoted him, and I have it here. He said, this is the president speaking, Assad. He said, Iran's actions, he called them a major breach of Syrian sovereignty at all levels, end quote. And then the network said that this is just a part of a negative trend facing the Iranian position in Syria and the entire region. So we're seeing those fractures appear, and the Bible prophesies in Psalm 83 that Syria is going to be part of a different alliance. They're not going to be allied with Iran, and we're starting to see that become more and more a reality.
Thank you for that, Warren. Warren has written an article about this. This will be up on the website on Monday. Israel strikes alleged Iranian munitions in Syrian port. You can watch for that at thetrumpet.com. The closure of one of the last pro-democracy websites in the country punctuated a stunning development we witnessed this past year, the death of democracy in one of the few outposts of democracy in Asia, that is Hong Kong. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, we've actually not spoken about Hong Kong in a while, and that's because in some big ways, it seemed like China's destruction of the city's freedoms that we'd been warning about for so long had basically happened in 2020, and it seemed like the story was essentially over. And in some ways, that is the case, but even still, 2021 did prove to be a year of almost a scorched earth chapter in China's destruction of everything that made Hong Kong unique and prosperous and free. So this year we saw almost 100,000 pro-democracy Hong Kongers flee abroad, and then more than 100 people didn't flee fast enough, and they were imprisoned this year under, various trumped-up charges because of the draconian national security law that was imposed on the city last year. We've also seen every single opposition voice driven out of the legislature this year. So Hong Kong's government now is entirely pro-Beijing, pro-Chinese Communist Party. This year, there were also numerous works of art and monuments that the Chinese government tore down. The main one of those was commemorating China's slaughter of pro-democracy protesters in Tiananmen Square back in 1989, one of the darkest days in all of history. And that monument, called the Pillar of Shame, it had been a fixture of Hong Kong for decades, but now it and several others like it are no more. They've been destroyed to make room for pro-Beijing monuments instead. And then this week, as you said, just as the year was almost over, the Chinese Communist Party sent 200 police officers to raid what was really the last vocal pro-democracy media outlet in Hong Kong. That was just on Wednesday, and it was the Stand News media outlet. So they're shut down now, and many of their editors and journalists have been arrested. They're being accused of sedition, and they're facing prison time, all because they dared to say that the people of Hong Kong should be given a voice. So, we may have thought that in 2020 the story was over, since the Chinese Communist Party had basically ended Hong Kong's freedoms. But looking back over this year, we see that they were not content with even those extreme measures that they had taken. And we see that China is bent on stamping out just every vestige, every trace of pro-democracy thinking and of, every iota of those freedoms that had made Hong Kong such a unique and exceptional city.
The way that China has been treating Hong Kong just shows so much about the character of this Asian giant. What has been the international response, and maybe the United States response to what's been happening here?
Yeah, it's, well, you know, it's what you would expect. Secretary of State Antony Blinken issued a statement on Wednesday calling on China to release the staff members that it had arrested. He said this latest move, on top of everything else that China's done, just undermines Hong Kong's viability and its credibility. Then the German government and the United Nations issued some similar statements, just saying that they were alarmed by China's crackdown on what little free speech and free press remained. But if there's one thing that we've learned about Xi Jinping and the Communist Party that he leads, it's that they have zero regard for the, you know, the opinions and the sermonizing that come from Western leaders. So these statements issued from the U.S. and other various Western capitals, they're only marginally better than silence. And China knows that those are just platitudes with nothing really behind them. So I don't think we should expect those statements to free those editors and journalists who are imprisoned or to really otherwise change China's behavior in the least.
There's really nothing changing China's behavior. It's just on a roll. And we've talked about this in terms of Bible prophecy, the shift toward a world that is led by powers such as China is really one that the Bible tells us we need to be very concerned about.
Yes, that's exactly right. And Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry has written about that shift that was prophesied. He wrote an article in our February 2020 issue. It's called The Climax of Man's Rule Over Man. And it's all about this shift from the world having basically the United Kingdom and the United States as the main global powers to a new era that the Bible calls the times of the Gentiles. And that's when, as you said, when nations like China are the main global powers. And when you look at Hong Kong, it's actually a remarkable, almost like a case study where you can see in a very direct, almost like a time-lapsed way, just what it means to transition from Anglo rule, you know, Pax Britannica, then Pax Americana, to these times of the Gentiles, when nations such as China will instead be the main powers. It was under Britain that Hong Kong became great. You know, this island was virtually uninhabited when the British raised their flag there back in the 1840s, and the Brits turned it into a thriving and just an incredibly wealthy hub of commerce, a very prosperous place. And the Hong Kongers really missed that. You know, no one says the British were perfect. We know that no human rules perfectly, but the fruits show that the British rule was overwhelmingly positive, and the Hong Kongers inherited just all kinds of amazing freedoms from the British, which they cherished. And that's why when you look at the protesters over the last few years, so many of them were waving the British flag and even the U.S. flag. They knew that that Anglo system meant freedom and prosperity, especially when you compare it to the Chinese system that has now taken over. Because Hong Kong now is a police state. It's ruled by fear and it's ruled by force. It's a place where people do exactly what the Chinese Communist Party says, or else they're, you know, they know that they'll be dealt with in the harshest ways. That's the kind of leadership that has replaced British rule. And Mr. Flurry's article shows that situations like the shift that we've seen in Hong Kong are only just the beginning. One part of his article says, "These times of the Gentiles are yet to be fully realized. However, we are in the outer edges of this catastrophic storm. Russia's and China's actions prove that Gentiles are rising to power before our eyes. This is the ghastly culmination of 6,000 years of man's rule over man. This is the nightmare awaiting mankind just ahead." So it's, you know, I think it's really sobering to see what's happening in Hong Kong. And it's even more so to know that this is just a small preview of just how oppressive the whole world is on its way to becoming.
The Climax of Man's Rule Over Man is the article that Gerald Flurry wrote on that subject. We'll link to in the show notes. We thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. One of the ways China has deeply affected our world is by unleashing COVID-19. It's turned our world upside down. Now, the Biden administration still says evidence pinning the blame on China is inconclusive, but a lot of people are not buying that, including one former president. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, as crime, inflation, supply chain shortages, and other problems plague America, Joe Biden's approval ratings are plummeting. And many Americans are thinking about what's Donald Trump up to these days. And so he's let us know. He's let us know it for the end of the year. He kind of did his own little year interview where he did a pretty lengthy year-end newsletter to his supporters that came out this Tuesday. And he spent a good bit of that newsletter talking about the coronavirus, specifically how the coronavirus is China's fault. Now, this newsletter, I guess, for a little context, it comes pretty quick on the heels of a recent interview Mr. Trump did with Fox News, where he said it was so obvious that the virus escaped from a laboratory in Wuhan. Although in the newsletter, he took that a step further and even accused Joe Biden of bowing down to China and joining Beijing's cover-up. Here's a couple quotes from the newsletter. It says, "The Biden administration has continually refused to hold China accountable for its role in the deadly spread of the coronavirus, opposing President Trump's demand that China pay trillions of dollars for the damage it has caused." And then a little later, it says, "One year in, Joe Biden is a failed president who has surrendered to the virus and broken his number one promise to the American people to end the pandemic once and for all." And then suggested that Biden should be removed from office. And so those are some pretty powerful statements that will probably resonate with a good bit of Americans. I believe the latest polls I've seen, if you trust those sort of things, say that 72% of Americans are convinced that the coronavirus did come from Wuhan, China, despite what Anthony Fauci and Francis Collins and Joe Biden may say. And now Trump's coming on and says that really, I mean, you talk about the debt we owe China. Trump saying, well, China really should owe us trillions of dollars just for the damage they've done to our economy by their cover up of this virus. I mean, it really, you'd think it would just be a little common sense would show you that the media people who are just trying to laugh this Wuhan leak theory to scorn are doing a pretty bad job of it. Because, I mean, like Wuhan, China, it's one of the number one bio research facilities in China. And it just so happens that, like, in all the cities of China, that's the one where the virus starts. I think I heard one comedian even making the case that you're like, hey, if there was a huge scandalous chocolate leak in Hershey, Pennsylvania, where's the first place you'd investigate? The Hershey Chocolate Company. And so it's like, if there's a huge bio leak in Wuhan, China, like what's common sense? So the first place that bio leak probably came from, like the Wuhan Institute of Virology. And then the Republican intelligence community has come out with more proof than that, just kind of like looking at the timetable that, like, yes, whether it was accidentally or on purpose, it almost assuredly came from there. And the Chinese bent over backwards to cover that up until it had already spread around the world, pretty much, even if it was an accident, pretty much taking the standpoint that, like, hey, well, if we're going to have a pandemic, everyone else is going down with us. We're not gonna lock down this city till it's spread. And so President Trump's got a point there that, like, you could, in most cases, like, let's just cancel our national debt, our debt to you and reparations for this virus you put all over the world. I do think that a lot of Americans are gonna start coming around to Trump's way of thinking on that issue and many other issues before not too long.
Yeah, you know, I guess looking at Joe Biden, and there's a lot of evidence of his having been influenced by China, that there's corruption there that might be influencing the way that he's dealing with China. There's also the point that you brought out in, I guess this was two trumpet issues ago, about just how much the radical left has used coronavirus as a tool to reshape America. They've actually, like, the fact that Donald Trump is coming out and saying, well, let's pin the blame where it belongs, there's no one on the left who has any interest in that because they've benefited so dramatically from this virus.
Right. I think one of the resources we can put in the show notes is from our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Flory, titled Where the U.S.-China Clash is Leading. And this was written pretty early on in the pandemic where he presents a good bit of the evidence that China was behind this and has the statement in there that really said the coronavirus has exposed the Chinese Communist Party like really nothing else ever has. But it's also kind of exposed the American deep state like few things ever have, because I mean, that's why the idea that this was leaked on purpose. And like I said, I definitely think it was leaked from Wuhan. Whether it was on purpose or not, we'll probably find out soon. But the idea that it was leaked on purpose is becoming more and more popular just due to the effect of like what you just said. It's kind of like, well, this coronavirus has given the radical left in America pretty much everything it ever wanted. Like an opportunity to flood the nation with mail-in ballots and steal an election, an opportunity to shut down the economy and reduce greenhouse gas emissions, an opportunity to do lockdowns and increase the government's power over people's lives. I think I saw one satire website, those who know me probably know which one it was, that said... that like Bernie Sanders is going to retire from politics because coronavirus has made him irrelevant. It's done everything that he's spent the last 80 years trying to do.
Yeah, well, we do have an article on our website. A new report exposes Wuhan Institute of Virology as epicenter of pandemic. That was this past summer. Andrew wrote that. There's also that article that was in the January Trumpet Edition, A Weapon to Transform America. And we'll also link to that article from Gerald Flory on Where the U.S.-China Clash is Leading. Thank you for that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, China is preparing for upcoming famines by hoarding food supplies. Europe is trying to secure its supplies by taking more federal emergency powers. We'll be right back.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
The coronavirus pandemic has put tens of millions of people at risk of famine, and food supplies are more insecure than they've been in decades. China has taken a bold step to protect its own interests. For this story, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, a new report in Nikkei Asia shows that China is stockpiling massive amounts of grain. This report says that if current trends persist, China will soon have 69% of the world's corn reserves, 60% of rice reserves, and 51% of wheat reserves. And China, of course, does have a colossal population, but that population only amounts to about 20% of the global population. So it's 20% of the world's people, but here they are stockpiling well over half of the world's corn and other grains. So this is just far beyond what's typical. And it does have some analysts thinking that China is planning for some sort of global cataclysm. It was 2 years ago that Zero Hedge commented on the start of China's increase in stockpiling grain and other items. And they wrote, quote, "Does China believe that we're on the verge of a major global crisis? The Communist Chinese government has always been very big into planning, and it appears that they've decided that now is the time to hoard food, gold, and other commodities." End quote. So that was 2019. And in the 2 years since that was written, China has dramatically increased those grain holdings. So it is sounding alarms and just raising a lot of questions about China's, you know, its expectations of the future and even what its intentions may be.
They do seem to think long term. This is a point that we talk about fairly often, that they're playing the long game and they're aware of just how important these food reserves are going to be. What do you see in other nations compared to China? How is the U.S. doing at stockpiling food?
Yeah, that's a very different story. You know, the numbers we just spoke about, it said that China will soon have 69% of corn, 60% of rice, and 51% of wheat. But if you look at the U.S., we do have stockpiles, but they only equate to 12% of the world's corn, 1% of rice, and 6% of wheat. So, you know, the U.S. population, of course, is only about a quarter of China's, but that still leaves a massive per capita discrepancy. It means that China has about 700 pounds of those grains stored away for every single Chinese person, while the U.S. only has half that, roughly, for every American. So just a very stark contrast there. And it means that in the event of major trade war or global famine, with all other things being equal, China could survive for probably twice as long as America.
How do you view this in light of the prophecies of the Bible? Famine is obviously something that features pretty heavily in end time biblical prophecy.
Yes. Yeah. Famine features prominently. And then there are also end time prophecies, especially in the books of Deuteronomy, Isaiah, and Ezekiel, that say trade war and economic besiegement, authored largely by China, will soon devastate the United States. And the scriptures show that weather calamity will strike America at the same time. So it adds up to a crisis that is severe almost beyond words. There's one passage in the book of Joel chapter 1, that describes some of this. It says, "The field is wasted, the land mourns, for the corn is wasted. The new wine is dried up, the oil languishes. Be you ashamed for the wheat and for the barley, because the field is perished, because joy is withered away from the sons of men." So, you know, just a very bleak, a very sobering picture is painted there of the future of America. And it does show, I think, why it's so alarming right now to see China stockpiling all kinds of food while the U.S. stores very little. And we've got an article going up on the website soon, or actually I think it's up there now. This is by Andrew, and it goes through all of those prophecies and just shows how desolate this future will be unless there's a dramatic change in America's direction.
All right, thank you very much, Jeremiah. Europe is also trying to secure its own supplies amid supply chain breakdowns, and to do so, it's undertaking something of a power grab. For this, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yeah, in some ways, this does quite closely relate to what Jeremiah was talking about. You know, countries are preparing for trade wars in very real and tangible ways, and this is the European Union doing that. You've got the United States, you've got China, obviously these big federal governments of large countries doing what they can to stockpile resources, to make sure that they can, well, especially in the case of China, you know, make sure they can control a lot of those resources. The European Union generally has been more like the United States in the past and hasn't bothered a huge amount about that. And then what they do tends to be done more at the national level. So now the European Union itself, the kind of the overarching government, is trying to grab some more power for itself, so that it can ensure that Europe isn't subject to supply chain shocks, or to use maybe more biblical language, besieged, cut off from some of these different resources. So one thing that, for example, that their internal messages brought up was that the European Union it gets 98% of its rare earth metals from China. Now, it has a good relationship with China at the moment, but that's a pretty glaring vulnerability. There's a global magnesium shortage that is really making itself felt in Germany's car industry. They all need a certain amount of magnesium, modern cars generally do. And getting a shortage of that has been a real headache for Germany. So in a New Year's message to his staff, the Internal Market Commissioner, Thierry Breton, he said that Brussels was going to put forwards a new law in the spring that would give the European Union a role in setting up some of these stockpiles in some of the things that, you know, in a similar way to what we just heard from Jeremiah. Breton apparently wrote that the tool of measures that can be achieved to ensure security of supply during a crisis would give the European Union powers to step in. It would give them export control power. So to tell countries, no, you cannot export more of this resource to other countries, we need this at home. Or to then go around to different European Union companies and get information from them. What's your current production? What's your projected projection. How much stockpiles do you have? So that the EU can behave much more strategically in this regard, and much more like China and less like the United States.
Jeremiah mentioned these trade wars, and the Bible actually talks about an anti-American alliance that includes China and European nations working together to undermine the United States.
And you can see how these proposals could be the beginning of something like that. You know, if you have the ability to say nobody in the EU is allowed to sell this particular product because we need it, it doesn't take very much to take that a little bit further and say nobody in the EU is allowed to sell this particular product to this particular company or this particular country, sorry, because we're punishing them, because we're targeting them. So this is setting up the infrastructure that could be used in a trade war in a very practical way. And I think the other thing that makes this news story remarkable is the Bible really does draw a lot of attention to the commercial side of this coming European empire. It really does stand out, I think, and as a unique characteristic of this coming European empire. And we talked about Revelation 17 in the first half. You go over to Revelation chapter 18, and it's full of these verses talking about merchants and what they're buying and what they're selling. And then once this empire falls, these merchants, the businessmen of the world, the people doing all of this trading, they're weeping, they're crying. They're the ones that really suffer from its fall. And Revelation 18 is not at all alone in that. You mentioned Isaiah chapter 23, the scriptures in Ezekiel that make similar prophecies. This is going to be an empire that has a very strong economic component, and not necessarily in a kind of a free trade capitalistic way, but one in which it can target and put sanctions and besiege particular nations, and one in which merchants and businessmen with good political links can make a whole lot of money. So when you see Europe getting involved in world trade like this, it ties in very strongly with the picture of this European power painted by the Bible.
It seems that European politicians, this is a point that Herbert Armstrong made years ago, that they are very good at taking advantage of crises. And the crisis that is posed by coronavirus and all of the supply chain disruptions and things that are going on now, really is something that they want to make sure that they do not squander, that they're able to secure more of the power that they need to push forward this European project. And we've really seen this same scenario play out several times, that they're very good at taking advantages of moments like this in order to push their plans forward. And it is exactly what we expect based on the prophecies of the Bible. Where would you send people for more information on the prophetic significance of this, Richard?
Well, we have a reprint article titled The Great Mart of Nations that was by Mr. Brad McDonald and Mr. Ron Fraser. I think the latest version of that was in the July 2016 Trumpet print edition. And that explains that particular prophecy and also brings in some of those other prophecies from Revelation 18 about this coming mercantile powerhouse.
All right, thank you for that. Richard, a new report shows that the level of Houthi attacks against Saudi Arabia more than doubled this past year. To learn about this, we'll go back to Warren Reinsch.
According to that report by the think tank, during the first 9 months of 2021, Houthi attacks against the Saudi kingdom averaged 78 per month, or 702 in total. During the same period in 2020, the report said that the monthly average was only 38. Seth Jones, a senior analyst for that think tank, said, quote, "It's very cheap for the Houthis and Iranians to produce and very expensive for the Saudis to defend against," end quote. The Houthis have often attacked. This is a big trend. We talk about it all the time here on the Trumpet. The Houthis always use these ballistic missiles, cruise missiles, and most especially drones, because they're very cheap and they're easy to use. They're not very effective, but because the Saudis use the Patriot, it's an American system, the Patriot air defense, each of those intercept missiles costs $1 million. So it's very expensive for Saudi Arabia to defend against these attacks, and it's very cheap and inexpensive for the Houthis to actually produce the missiles and to attack. And that's why it's so detrimental to Saudi Arabia. The report said the drones do not cause significant physical damage on their own, but they demonstrate the continued vulnerability of the infrastructure, such as airports, to the Houthi attacks. And if you remember, a couple of years ago, there was an attack on the Saudi oil processing facility. That attack was claimed by the Houthis. So they have more capabilities than we usually give them credit for, but under most circumstances, what they're using is just relatively low tech, and it's just they're more of a nuisance. But what they're doing is they're focusing these attacks on Saudi Arabia nearby, and then they're starting to even use these missiles, now that they've increased their capabilities, on oil tankers and maritime trade. Maritime attacks against oil tankers have increased quite a bit. The Houthis conducted 24 successful or attempted attacks using drones just between January 2017 and then June 2021. And most of those attacks occurred around Yemeni ports right there near the Bab al-Mandeb Strait, which is an important strait that allows trade to go into the Red Sea and then through the Suez Canal towards Europe.
So this is really more evidence of just the threat that Iran poses in the region. It's important to recognize the Houthis are very robustly supported by Iran. And the fact that they're increasing these attacks against Saudi Arabia, it underscores this this divergence within the region, this kind of struggle for power between Saudi Arabia and these Arab states, and then this and then Iran, this Persian Empire that is continually extending its power through the region, using these proxies like the Houthis.
Correct. Yeah, and usually, you know, we didn't really talk about how Iran has been involved in this, but there, I think I even saw an article earlier this week where there was a Houthi ambassador who was flown home from Yemen to Iran. There was a lot of complications between it. There was some coordinating with the Saudi government, the Iraqi government. They ended up getting him back, but then articles later showed that this was a guy who he had changed his name, but his previous name was a very popular name, and he was actually an Iranian general. So I guess he might have fell sick or he got injured, and Iran did everything they could to get him home. But it shows that, you know, Iran had a military leader. They had a general right there with the Houthis, training them, guiding them, telling them what to do. So the Houthis very much are a proxy of Iran, and they're just people that they're a tool that Iran uses to even threaten Israel. You know, we talked about in the first story where Iran has usually been going through Syria, using that land bridge from Syria to Lebanon to attack Iran. But Israel has conducted so many airstrikes, they're having to find other ways to get there. And one of those ways to put more pressure on Israel is right here. They're able to put pressure on that strait. And then I think another thing that a lot of people forget is that, the Middle East isn't that large. And the Houthi territory, those missiles are actually in range, or they're able to strike Israel from where they're at. So right now they're just attacking Saudi Arabia, but I wouldn't be surprised in some point in the future to see the Houthis, get a little more bold to push a little bit more at Israel and to start firing missiles at Israel. So they really are a real threat that we need to keep an eye on.
Iran is the king of the South, as Bible prophecy terms it. Our editor-in-chief wrote a booklet by that title showing Iran's role in biblical prophecy. We'll link to that in the show notes. Thank you very much for that, Warren. Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg and his wife spent nearly $500 million on election operations in 2020, supposedly to promote safe and reliable voting. That's a lot of money. Evidence is it didn't make the 2020 election more fair. For this story, we'll go back to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, the particular organization that spent that $419 million was the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative, which is named after Mark Zuckerberg and his wife, Priscilla Chan. And for more evidence of just how partisan and radical this Chan Zuckerberg Initiative is, It's recently been revealed, just within the past week or so, that they've hired a member of the steering committee of the Democratic Socialist of America. The Democratic Socialist of America is an openly socialist group that's been recruiting members to join the Democratic Party, basically in an attempt to convert the Democratic Party into a full-fledged Marxist party from within. So one of the most radical groups in America. And yet Zuckerberg and his wife decided to hire Megan Ursko to serve in their initiative, despite the fact that she was on the steering committee of the Democratic Socialist of America and has bragged on Twitter, LinkedIn, and other places that she's actually still a dues-paying member of the Los Angeles National Chapter of the Democratic Socialist of America. And so any claims that they have that this this organization is to promote free and fair election should be debunked by the fact that they're recruiting some of the most radically far left people in America to serve on this initiative, and then there's plenty of other evidence as well. I believe Molly Hemingway wrote a book titled "Rigged: How the Media, Big Tech, and the Democrats Seized Our Elections," where she really breaks down that, like, yes, Mark Zuckerberg did spend almost $500 million on this election, but he didn't donate this money randomly to election offices across the country. He specifically gave it to election offices in Democrat areas of big cities in swing states, and so that they could try to send out reminders and other things to get as many people as possible to vote in those big Democratic strongholds in the swing states. And then there was also some activity where he was actually staffing some of those offices, using that money with people who could actually make regulatory decisions to change election laws at the last minute. That second thing, changing election laws at the last minute, is definitely illegal, or at least unconstitutional. But the first thing about giving money to just get the vote out in these big cities, it's not necessarily overtly illegal, but it's definitely an effective way to rig an election. If you've got all the Democratic strongholds with, like, boots on the ground trying to remind people to come to the polling offices, while you don't have the same thing happening in conservative parts of the country, which is why President Trump's come right out and called Zuckerberg a criminal for what he's done for this. Dr. Peter Navarro, who wrote a 3-part series on how the election was rigged, has basically done the same thing, showing that really this this initiative and Zuckerberg runs Facebook was one of the big ways that the Democrats could use mail-in ballots and rig things in many offices across the country, because legally each election office is kind of responsible for running its own elections. But then if you have an organization like this that's giving money to organizations that run elections a certain way, it's almost kind of a way to, like, federalize local elections without having the federal government do it. In this case, it's the government's using Facebook to federalize elections and then claiming the government's not do it because it was a private charity.
It's quite a mess. And the idea of what it's going to take to restore America to free and fair elections, it really is going to take a war, as our editor-in-chief has put it. We do have an article about this on the website from Andrew Miller. Zuckerberg's election rigging group hires Democratic Socialists of America leader. Go check that out at thetrumpet.com. Thank you very much, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that's it for today's Trumpet Hour. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Warren Reinch, and Richard Palmer. Thanks to Nick Irwin, Parker Campbell, and Dwight Falk for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of Max Lucado: "A man who wants to lead the orchestra must turn his back on the crowd." Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.